Welcome to the Autism Roundtable. I'm Leah Gross, founder of Circle Care Services. I'll bring you autism experts from all kinds of fields for helpful parenting ideas, insights, and strategies. Tune in for learning and support and connection. Dr. Flansbaum to the Autism Roundtable. We are so happy that you could join us today. You come with so many amazing hats in the autism world and in the neurodiverse world. Can you please introduce yourself a little bit? Tell us about your background, your professional background, and your personal background.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me, first of all. I'm really grateful for the opportunity to speak with you, to be able to speak with your listeners. I am a licensed psychologist. I'm really passionate about working with children, adolescents, young adults, and families. I also love to teach, and I am the founder of a practice in New Jersey. We now provide telehealth to the broader population throughout the country. It's called the Center for Cognitive Behavior Therapy. We provide specialized care for children and families. And the goal or the vision that I really had when we started the practice was to be able to create a one-stop shop for families where they're able to be able to get expert care. And so that's why actually when I started the practice many years ago, it was just me. But I called the practice Center for Cognitive Behavior Therapy because my goal was to be able to treat families that are within my specialization, which is primarily Tourette syndrome, trichotillomania, anxiety. And I do treat those, you know, in relation to kids that have autism as well. And then I also work with, I also intended to be able to grow the practice to bring in doctors with other specializations. We have grown to be able to specialize. We have a few doctors who work in feeding disorders such as ARFID. We have a whole team of clinicians that provide therapy for children with children, adolescents, young adults with depression, suicidality, cutting, and self-injury. We have a pediatric neuropsychologist on our team that does evaluations for autism as well as learning difficulties. And so it's been really great. I'm really passionate about what I do. I love going to work every day. And then when I come home from work, I am married. I have a wonderful wife. She also happens to double as a psychologist.
Oh, wow.
And then I have two wonderful girls.
Wow. It sounds like a busy life.
It is. It's a lot of fun.
A lot of fun and fulfilling, though.
Yes, it really is. One other hat that I wear is I do really enjoy teaching, and I am on the faculty at Rutgers Medical School, and I am in charge of the CBT training program for the child psychiatry fellows. I co-teach there with a colleague.
Very amazing. Kay, you want to explain to us a little bit about what CBT, is that what you said you're the
yes.
teacher? Okay, so tell us a little bit about it and what those the acronym stands for.
Sure. So within psychology, there are a number of different approaches to working with families. And the approach that I have taken is based on a theory called cognitive behavior therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy. And CBT is a treatment that has been extensively studied and researched. It generally aims to be goal-oriented and time-limited in terms of how it is implemented. And so there are, for example, treatments to be able to help children with anxiety, treatments to be able to help children with depression. As they are studied, we kind of put them into like structured packages, and then we can work with families and be able to give them an idea of approximately how long it's going to be able to take to help them and be able to give them pretty concrete strategies that we're going to be able to use. So in terms of CBT in particular, to give the 1 minute crash course, cognitive behavior therapy is really kind of thought of as being, you know, a triangle, the CBT triangle we refer to as. And we have thoughts, we have physiological feelings, and then we have actions. And in the middle, we may have, for example, our emotion that we're experiencing. So for example, when we think about the cognitive behavior therapy or the CBT triangle, you can think about if you were walking down the block and you saw an ice cream store, right? You might think to yourself, oh, wow, that seems really yummy, right? And perhaps you'll have that physiological reaction. You might salivate a little bit. And what kind of action is that likely to spur? It's probably going to make you say to your friend, hey, let's go in, right? And so you walk in the door and you buy yourself some ice cream. But other people may have a slightly different reaction, right? If you think about somebody who's lactose intolerant and they walk by, their thought might be, oh man, I wish there was something I can eat there, right? And they're not going to be salivating over it. And their action might be to keep walking or to walk away or say, hey, let's hit up a coffee shop instead. And so that same model works in terms of our emotions. Right. And, you know, it's kind of like that pathological model as well in terms of, you know, if somebody is having, you know, a difficulty related to anxiety or depression, right, they may have anxious thoughts like, I'm going to embarrass myself, I'm going to sound stupid, this isn't going to go well, you know, their heart may start beating, and that may result in avoidance of, say, raising their hand or engaging in a social situation. And so our model is all about teaching from that framework. Right, we can teach a number of different strategies and skills to be able to help kids get better
and reframe their thoughts. Is that a piece of it or not necessarily?
Yeah, so there's kind of like two elements. One piece would be about kind of reframing their thoughts. You know, kind of if we change the way we think, we can change the way we feel, we can change the way we act. But also I would say it's about changing the way we act. You know, sometimes it's not just about changing our thoughts. Sometimes we have to just change the way we act. And actually, if we change the way we act, that can help us to change the way that we feel and the way that we think. So it goes both ways.
Fascinating. Love it. Okay. Now that we got a good framework on CBT, one of the fields that I know you specialize in is Tourette's syndrome, which is a really interesting topic that we haven't explored yet on this podcast. So I guess I would love to start with just a broad overview of what it is, what the symptoms are, and then we'll go on to some common misconceptions.
So when we think about Tourette syndrome, I usually think about it by first defining tics. So tics are these kind of sudden, rapid, repetitive, non-rhythmic movements, or vocalizations or sounds. And so we may think of them as being, you know, rapid eye blinks, or we may think of them as being, you know, mouth movements where individuals kind of like open their mouth really wide all of a sudden, or maybe they will kind of like raise their shoulder and flail out their arm. There also may be sounds that individuals exhibit, such as throat clearing or like a bird noise that they may make. So when we think about tics, there are kind of two categories for tics. They're what we call motor tics and vocal tics. So motor tics are movements throughout the body that individuals may exhibit. And vocal tics are sounds that individuals may make. They're sometimes referred to as phonic tics. So let's talk about when Tourette syndrome comes in. So if you think about a Venn diagram and you have vocal tics on one side and motor tics on another side, and then you have Tourette syndrome as being in the middle. So some individuals will have just motor tics, some individuals will have just vocal tics, and some individuals will have multiple motor tics and some vocal tics, which is really what we call Tourette syndrome or Tourette's disorder. The reason I like to explain it like that is because a lot of families have misconceptions about what is, you know, what exactly their child has. And I think it's unfortunate because it leads to negative thoughts, leads to negative assumptions that may not necessarily be accurate. So when individuals have multiple motor tics and vocal tics, they simply have what we call Tourette syndrome. You know, ever so often we have a family that comes in and they say, well, I don't actually think that my child has Tourette syndrome. I view them as having vocal tics and motor tics. Well, vocal tics and motor tics simply means Tourette syndrome. It's kind of one and the same. But I think people are concerned, well, what does it mean if my child has both versus one? There really isn't a difference in terms of your outcome, generally speaking. You know, we don't treat a diagnosis. What we're really treating in therapy is we're treating a behavior, right? We're treating the particular tic that your child exhibits, just like you would get any other treatment for any other particular symptom that you have.
Wow. And what, where are these tics coming from? Are the children or individuals born with it, or is it sometimes caused by emotional things? What is the root of tics?
So that's a great question, and we don't really have a great answer to it, but I can shed a little bit of light on it. It is thought that tics are going to be biologically rooted, and they tend to be related to some activity that's going on in the basal ganglia, a part of your body that has to do with movement. And tics are highly hereditary. In other words, many families who have children with tics, either the parents themselves have tics or the grandparents have tics. Oftentimes, parents or grandparents have tics. I even observe it in my office, but they may be more mild, and so parents don't even associate themselves as actually having tics. But it is highly hereditary. And I would add, in terms of what you said about are they caused by stress or something of that nature, is that there is a misconception that tics are caused by stress. But in truth, tics are not caused by stress. If individuals have stress in their life, they may exhibit tics. If individuals don't have stress in their life, they will exhibit tics. If that stress suddenly goes away, the tics are not going to disappear. But what does happen is we know that there are certain factors that may exacerbate or make tics a little bit worse. So we have tics, but then when individuals do become stressed or anxious, that can increase the frequency or the intensity of those tics, just the same as fatigue tends to increase the frequency or intensity of tics. And interestingly, for many kids, excitement can actually trigger an increase in tics as well. That's one of the ways that it tends to overlap a little with autism and stereotypy and movements like that.
Wow. And what is the treatment for tics? Is there anything that, obviously they're coming into you for something. So what kind of things are you focusing on to help an individual with tics? Sorry, with Tourette's syndrome. Or tics, really, because we're really separating it into motor, vocal, and Tourette's. So what kind of, treatment might they be seeking when they come to you?
Sure. So the separation is really just academic, right? They're either having motor tics, which means they have motor tics. We have vocal tics, which means they have vocal tics. Or if they have motor and vocal tics, they're just having Tourette syndrome, right? So it's fine to say we're treating Tourette's. It's fine to say we're treating the tics. I mean, ultimately, we're really treating those particular tic movements. So how do we do that? For decades, the treatment of choice for treating Tourette syndrome was really medication. Over the past, I would say, 25 years or so, there's been a resurgence in research on behavior therapy for tics. And the main behavior therapy that's used is something that's is a treatment that's referred to as habit reversal therapy, or habit reversal training. And so this is actually a treatment that was developed, initially for nail biting behaviors and skin picking behaviors in the late 70s. But there really wasn't much follow-up until in the early 2000s. And that treatment of habit reversal has a few core components. It focuses on helping individuals to, number one, become aware of the tics that they are experiencing. Number two, to be able to obtain social support, right, for, helping them utilize their strategies once they are aware of their tics. And then number three would be able to use what we refer to as a competing response or a particular behavior they can do instead of their tics. And so the idea is that an individual can learn to become aware of their tics. And once they become aware of their tics, they can engage in some kind of competing behavior or blocking strategy. Oftentimes with kids, I call it a tic buster, to be able to do instead of actually doing the tic. And so this is a way of managing your tics so that when you're in a social situation or if your tics are physically painful, you can implement these particular strategies.
Okay, so I know stimming is... we talk about masking in autism a lot, and it's in reference, to a bunch of different things, but stimming is one of them where some people on the autism spectrum will say that when we mask a stim or we have individuals stop stimming, that it has psychological effects on them because maybe that's an outlet that they needed. How does that correlate with tics? Is it when we're going to do this treatment where we teach them sort of to keep their tics at bay? And even you mentioned that they might be hurting themselves when doing that particular tic. I could just imagine. I've seen the shoulder one. That must not feel great. Or I've seen the neck movement one a lot as well. That must not feel great. So how do you sort of look at that piece?
Sure. So the first thing that we're going to do when we are seeing in kids with tics or individuals with tics is we have to do a thorough assessment to understand what's going on and make sure that what we're dealing with is tics, right? Once we know we're dealing with tics, then we can also assess, is our goal to be able to reduce the tics, or is our goal to be able to help individuals live life with tics? So on the idea, though, of if our goal is to be able to, on the idea of are we talking about tics? What I think about is this the same as stimming or is this a tic? And so when we think about stimming, I usually understand stimming to be a behavior that children are exhibiting in order to be able to obtain some level of what we would call positive reinforcement. In other words, it is a experience for them that they engage in, and it is in some way for them soothing or pleasurable, and therefore they are more likely to engage in that behavior again. You can definitely let me know if you see it differently. I know you have
So I'll tell you, I'm actually in school right now to become a behavior analyst, and you're right on. The way they would say it is automatic positive reinforcement, because it's automatic because their body is giving them that that positive reinforcement. What that positive reinforcement is, I guess, depends on each individual, but usually it's some sort of soothing, some sort of regulation. And we usually see these behaviors not done when with other individuals. So usually positive reinforcement is an individual is giving the other individual praise or anything positive, but this is like an automatic positive reinforcement.
Exactly. Another example I often use with kids, particularly when I'm working with schools and working in classrooms, is you see kids that are like leaning back. I mean, now a lot of desks are attached to their chairs, but prior they're just kind of like leaning back like this. I think that's just another example of this automatic positive reinforcement. And I also think of something like extreme, like skydiving. Why do you do it? It's just like that good, amazing, awesome feeling, at least for the people for whom it's a good feeling. It's kind of like that idea of automatic positive reinforcement. So if we say that stimming is based on automatic positive reinforcement, that really distinguishes it from a tic. Because a tic, when we think about understanding it on a behavioral level and at a theory level, a tic is really going to be exhibited in order to avoid the discomfort that they are experiencing, right? It's not quite automatic negative reinforcement, but one could think of it more in that camp than in the automatic positive reinforcement camp. In other words, the goal when an individual may be stimming, you know, is that they are getting that satisfaction. The goal when an individual exhibits a tic is that they are removing they're removing an uncomfortable experience. That was the word I was looking for. So oftentimes when I explain tics to families, I'll talk about the idea that tics kind of happen in a cycle. So what happens is you can picture an individual who has, say, a mosquito bite. Right. And Mrs. Gross, if you want, I'll take you through this analogy and you can play along. You have a mosquito bite, right? What is the number one rule when we have a mosquito bite?
Don't itch it.
Exactly. Right. We don't want to scratch the mosquito bite. But why do we scratch the mosquito bite?
Because we get that automatic positive reinforcement. We feel good when we itch it, and then at that moment, it feels good because it itches. So you want to itch, but.
Yeah. So we have the uncomfortable. I think of it with tics a little more as we have the uncomfortable feeling of the itch, right?
That's true.
And when we have the uncomfortable feeling of the itch, like what do we all want to do when we have an uncomfortable feeling?
Get out of it.
We all want to get rid of it, right? And so what happens is that we have this itch, right? And because we have this itch, it feels uncomfortable. We want to get rid of it, right? And therefore, we will scratch. And when we scratch, what happens? We feel better, right? But of course, when you scratch your mosquito bite, What does that actually do?
Makes you want to scratch more.
It just makes you want to scratch more. So you end up going around in a cycle. And with a tick, it's the same way, right? A tick you can think of as beginning with an urge or this physiological sensation or this itch that you have in a way, right? You may notice it behind your eyes for an eye tick. You may notice it in the back of your neck for a neck tick. And because you have that uncomfortable feeling, what you want to do is you want to try to get rid of it. The way you get rid of it is by exhibiting your tick. And when you exhibit your tick, that results in temporary relief, right? It's short-term discomfort. But in the long run, your itch is just going to continue. Your urge is just going to resurface, right? And so with that idea, then we're able to use our treatment strategies. And when we're blocking them, unlike when we were talking about stimming behavior, it is desirable to actually stop it because it's uncomfortable for the person as they're exhibiting it, right?
Wow.
So does that make sense?
Yeah, you brought so much clarity to the topic. Amazing. And I, like I said, I'm in school to become a behavior analyst, and I know stimming is a huge topic as far as, you know, whether we should allow children to stim or not. And I also like how you said that you sort of get to the bottom of it and you have a discussion, and it's something that the individual wants to stop. Like, it's not something that's forced, but rather they're coming for treatment because it's sort of uncomfortable.
Yes, without going too much without getting too sidetracked here, something that often happens in my meetings with families is whenever I meet with a child, I always ask them, so whose idea was it to come here? Is this your idea or is this your parents' idea? And the reason is because tics are one of those unique conditions that, you know, you really wear on the outside, right? When somebody is anxious, nobody can necessarily tell, right? If you're good at facing your fears, nobody knows that your stomach is rumbling. Right. But if you are doing motor movements, if you are making various vocalizations or sounds, the outsiders know. Right. And that can result in other people around you at times becoming bothered. But many times kids themselves are actually not bothered by their tics. And so we don't necessarily need to recommend treatment for them, but what we could actually recommend is some support for the parents, some education for the teachers so that they can learn what their number one strategies often are, which is to notice and kind of watch, but not necessarily to react to their child's tics. Because what happens is when parents react negatively to their child's tics, while we understand parents are not perfect, they're doing the best they can, they're gonna make mistakes, that's okay, right? But what ends up happening is they're unintentionally increasing the frequency of their child's tics. Because remember, we said one of those things that increases the frequency of tics is stress, right? So if parents are telling their child, stop it, or if parents are seeming frustrated, that in turn triggers urges, which in turn triggers an increase in tics.
Yeah, and I always say about parents, being a parent myself, that I don't think we ever want to do anything wrong. And sometimes it's just nature and it happens. But when we get education and when we understand what we're looking at, it gives us a better path. And everyone always feels better when there's guidance and you feel like you're doing the right thing. You know, like doing things blindly, it's hard. It's not easy. So thank you for sharing all this information, because I think it'll give guidance to people that are curious about the topic.
Absolutely. I think knowledge is power, and knowledge helps with acceptance.
Exactly. And I do think that each child's so individual. And I love the word acceptance, because I think that that's number one with all of our children, whatever they have and whichever package they come with, acceptance is key.
I completely agree.
Right. Are there any big ways that you share with parents, or just key tips that you would give to parents for that piece of acceptance?
For acceptance? Yeah, a couple things come to mind. One of them is just, you know, this is a little bit of an anecdote that happened with one of my kids. I remember years ago when I was taking one of my children to visit their grandmother, to visit their great-grandmother, to visit my grandmother. I was taking them, and my grandmother at that time was living in an assisted living facility. And it's, you know, always a scene when you walk in, because there are a whole number of chairs and, you know, The men and women are sitting around talking to each other, many of them just looking around. And, you know, I walk in holding my, you know, 4 or 5 year old's hand. And, you know, as we walked in, somebody walked, somebody who was sitting called us over and they said to my child, hello, how are you? And she said, good. And then they said, and so what is your name? And she shared what her name is. And then the woman said, and where do you live? And she said where she lived. And then she asked another question or two. And she said, and what is your name? And she said her name again. And she said, and where do you live? And she said, where do you live? Right. And you can imagine what's happening here, right? If you were to be in a conversation with somebody and they were to ask you the questions over and over again, you might feel a little frustrated, right? But then you take a step back, right? And as I talked about with my daughter, why were they asking you the same question over and over again? And in this case, of course, the answer is obvious. They're probably asking you when you look at the context and you're in a nursing home or you're in a assisted living facility, they're asking you because they have dementia, right? And all of a sudden, what happens is your frustration kind of dissipates, right? And, you know, in a way, it's kind of like the sin to illness model in a way. You can think of it as at first you're really frustrated, but then you recognize what's happening. And so I think what's so important about working with families with Tourette syndrome is that when you understand what's going on with your child, a lot of times that helps you to ride the wave of challenges more effectively, because it is really challenging. And being able to remember that, you know, with many things in life, when we understand what's going on, right, that helps us to be able to accept our reality. You know, I think that that's really helpful.
I agree. Thank you for sharing that. That's amazing. And I like the way that you're bringing up the whole perspective taking. Is if we change our perspective and we see things differently, then sometimes acceptance is that much easier. And I always say, like, rip up that sheet of paper with expectations and deal with what is exactly in front of you. And sometimes it's hard to make that list of what's in front of you and capabilities and, right, and what's there. But as soon as we're able to accept what's in front of us, I think moving forward is that much easier.
I completely agree. And I think that that's so true for children with Tourette syndrome. But I also think that that's true for when we're parents and we have children with autism, or we have children with anxiety, or we have children with depression. And that's really true on a broader level as well. We all may go to work and we should be blessed to love what we do every day, but there are still challenges with a supervisor, with a colleague. And when you take somebody, right, when you take a job, when you have a child, right, you really get the whole package, right? And your task in a way as a parent, right, is to be able to recognize and appreciate the totality of your child, right, with all of their strengths, as well as recognizing those challenges.
Very insightful. And I think always it's something that we have to just constantly remind ourselves. You know, like you said, all children across all neurotypical, neurodiverse, whatever it is that we're dealing with, it's an important lesson to always bring to the front of our minds. Okay, the next topic I wanted to discuss is anxiety. I know that you work with that as well a lot. And I would have to say that from when I started my practice about 15 years ago till today, I feel like we've seen like an uptick of anxiety where we're seeing so much of it. So I guess let's start with just explaining what anxiety is, if possible, and then maybe you could speak to what you think might be that rise, or maybe it's just that now we're diagnosing it or paying attention to it. So give us a little of your thoughts.
Sure. So one way to think about anxiety would be to think about it in terms of alarms, right? All children go to school every day, and or when they go to school, you know, there is a fire alarm system, right? And what happens when that fire alarm system, you know, goes off, right? So what happens is that the alarm goes off. And when the alarm goes off, children may think to themselves, what often happens when the fire alarm system is children get all excited, right? But let's talk about what should happen, right? Because they're like, oh, we're missing class. But what happens when the fire alarm goes off is somebody may think to themselves, fire, 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 right? And then what happens is you get a little bit of a, you know, your heart starts to beat a little bit, right? It's a little bit of like that startle response, right? Or maybe you get a little couple butterflies in your stomach, right? That's that physiological reaction. And then you will likely take action, right? You're going to run away, right? When the alarm goes off, you think fire, you feel physiologically, you feel fire, right? And then you act as if there's fire, which is that you run away, right? That's that triangle that we talked about at the beginning, right? And when we run out of the building, most of the time what that means is that we are safe, right? Now, there are really different kinds of alarms that happen though, right? There are what we call real alarms or true alarms, and then there are false alarms. So sometimes what happens is the alarm goes off in the building and you think fire, you feel fire, you act fire, you run out of the building, right? And you're in the building collapses behind you and you're like, wow, thank God I left, right? That's a real alarm. But other times what happens is the same alarm goes off, but you think fire, you feel fire, you act fire, as in you run out of the building and there is no fire. In many ways, that is what anxiety is, right? Or at least that is what clinical anxiety is, right? It's the idea that the alarm is going off and telling you danger, 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 don't raise your hand. Danger, danger, danger. You can't walk up to that person. It's not going to go well. You can't go to school. You're going to embarrass yourself. Somebody, you know, something bad's going to happen, right? And so you avoid in the absence of any actual danger. And so in many ways, I think of clinical anxiety as being kind of like false alarm anxiety. It's anxiety where the alarm is going off, but there is no actual threat or danger. Of course, we know that anxiety is, you know, a healthy emotion, right? We all should feel anxiety, right? It is good when the alarm goes off and you run outside. I often tell this story when I am interacting with folks, interacting with clients. One of my first experiences in training was at Bellevue Hospital. I was part of an internship program at the NYU Child Study Center in Bellevue Hospital. It was an amazing experience. I loved it there. Such wonderful children. Who are struggling so much, it really is a privilege to be able to help them. And my very first day, I was up on the 20th or 21st floor, which is the top floor, and the alarm went off. And, you know, like any regular person would do, the alarm goes off and I like stand up and I, you know, walk out of my office and I notice that nobody is doing anything. And then I actually knocked on the door next to me to a woman who it turns out would be my supervisor while I was there. And I said, I said, hi, my name is Mayor. What's your name? Do you notice that the alarm is going off? like nobody is doing anything. Aren't we supposed to go outside? And she said, oh, no, it's no problem. The alarm always goes off. And I remember thinking to myself, being somebody who had a lot of background in anxiety and the treatment of anxiety, that if there's ever, God forbid, a fire in this hospital, right, everybody's going to die because this is how anxiety doctors think. They think in extremes, right? This is what we think about when we go on planes. How can we get good material for stories is what we really think about. And so the idea is that anxiety is a healthy and adaptive emotion. We are supposed to feel startled when the fire alarm goes off, right? But sometimes what's happening is that alarm is going off in the absence of any real threat or danger. And those are the kiddos that land in people's offices. And those are the kiddos whose parents would benefit from reading different books on anxiety, you know, to be able to support their kids.
Are there any books that you like have off the top of your head that you think parents should read if they have children with anxiety?
Great question. There is a book, I don't know the titles. There is a book written by a close colleague of mine for little kids on anxiety. Her name is Dr. Regine Galanti. There is a book for parents that is written by Anne Marie Albano, but I don't recall the title right off the top of my head. But
okay, we can always include them in the session notes after, yeah.
Yes, that sounds great. I'm happy to provide those and others.
Okay, amazing. So is it true that there's an uptick in anxiety today than there was, let's say, yesteryear when we were growing up?
Yeah, so I certainly believe there's been an uptick. It's interesting because when I speak with one of my parents, we often end up in conversations about, was it easier for you to raise me than it was for us to be raising our kids now? And certainly I think there are challenges, you know, in both situations. But I think anxiety is an area where there is an increase, but there are a couple of reasons that could be contributing to it. One of those reasons could relate to the challenges and stresses of society, the expectations that kids have. Perhaps it's related to, you know, to kids' own desires, wishes, freedoms, and expectations they put on themselves. Another one could be an increase in education, right? And when we understand what's going on, there's greater openness. For example, particularly in the Jewish community in the last 5 to 10 years, I think there's been a tremendous increase in a recognition that there are mental health challenges and a greater willingness to be able to seek help. So I think, you know, that also may be a part of it, right? It's not necessarily just that there's more anxiety. It could be that people know what anxiety is. And so instead of tough it out, you're doing well, you just got to deal with it, there's a little more of, wow, it sounds like you're really struggling right now. Why don't you talk to a doctor about it? So I think there is an increase in anxiety. The White House has constructed some type of panel. I'm slipping on what it's called, like a task force, you know, that was specifically identified because of the fact that they've noticed a tremendous increase in anxiety since about 2010, upwards of like right after COVID when those numbers came out. And then certainly, you know, the challenges with COVID, people seem to think, you know, is resulting in an increase of anxiety. What also could be happening, though, is that we're just on a path where the number has been going up. It didn't start increasing right at COVID. That number has been going up for at least a decade.
Wow. Okay. Each generation has its own challenges, right? So we'll deal with them. What might be a way to deal with anxiety? What are some treatments that you might offer to a child or an adult that comes in with anxiety disorder?
Sure. So there are a couple of options you have when you're addressing anxiety. There are behavior therapies, the kind of treatment that I do in my office and many psychologists do. And there also is a medication option. So parents do really have two choices. They can go with pills or they can go with skills.
Is there also like a combination of the two?
Yep, that was exactly what I was about to mention. So oftentimes we actually see the combination. And so the question really becomes not is therapy good or is behavior therapy or CBT good or is medication a good option? As much as they're both good options, but are the right kids getting access to the right treatment? And so many times when children or adolescents are struggling a little bit, maybe even more moderately, then it makes sense for them to consider therapy. However, if they are struggling, you know, more greatly, then we may start with medication. And occasionally we may actually recommend the combination of the two. So if you needed like a algorithm, it would be, you know, the mild to moderate anxiety, we would start with therapy. The more moderate to severe anxiety, we would start with medicine. And then, you know, obviously we have to look at each individual child to be able to determine which of those options or both is going to make the most sense.
Now, what's the right stop for a parent that has a child with anxiety? Where do they start their journey?
So there are a couple places you can start your journey. I generally find that most parents' first stop is their pediatrician. And pediatricians can be a great resource for general information about mental health challenges. For some, if medication is indicated, they may even be comfortable prescribing. Other pediatricians are not comfortable prescribing medicine. But generally at this point, I think pediatricians recognize, acknowledge, and support medication when it's appropriate and therapy when it's appropriate, based on the clinical needs. And also, of course, we have to take into account parent preferences. Parents are going to have strong feelings about medication sometimes in terms of the stigma, in terms of concern about side effects. And so if you're talking to your pediatrician, it's important to make sure that that's somebody you're comfortable with. Do you believe that they're hearing your perspective? Do you believe that they're valuing your input? And if so, I think that's a great first step. The other option, if parents have already kind of decided that their child has anxiety would be to be able to call a child psychologist, to be able to call, you know, a reputable social worker that they know, to be able to gather more information. When you are getting that initial evaluation, it doesn't mean that you are signing up for therapy. At least that's not how I would think of it. I think knowledge is power, and it can be really valuable to have an initial appointment with a clinician, gather information, learn, hear what they have to say, and then make a decision about, you know, whether treatment is indicated or not. The first stop that most parents do have, which wasn't the question you asked me, is Google. So I do think that the internet is a wonderful resource. At the same time, I often talk about the internet as being a sea of information and an ocean of misinformation. And so there is wonderful information out there on the internet, and there also are a lot of sites that are just not reputable. I don't tell families stay off the internet. I don't need to say something and then automatically have noncompliance. I know you're going to go on the internet. But what I would say is go on the internet, do all the research you want, but go back and talk to somebody about what you read who is an expert in that area so that you can know whether what you're reading is helpful or whether it's just making you anxious about something that isn't actually based in science.
Wow. And then once an individual starts treatment for anxiety, is that a long-term treatment? Is that a short-term treatment? And what kind of modalities are you offering them?
The length of treatment is always a tricky question because there are so many individual differences. And so what we know is that there are studies on cognitive behavior therapy for the treatment of anxiety that'll generally hover around 16 to 20 sessions. That tells us that we can give you a ballpark of if your kid is a worrier about test taking or thunderstorms or their grades, you know, if they're concerned about, you know, social situations and how they're going to be perceived, right? We know that, you know, we have an anchor, you know, in research to be able to kind of provide an estimate. At the same time, many kids come, you know, in, you know, every child is different. You know, if you've seen, you know, one child with anxiety, you've seen one child with anxiety, just the same as in autism. And so, you know, I think many parents can feel misled if they're given a quote for how long treatment is. And so I often remind parents that this is an anchor based on, you know, some studies, but those studies were not with your child, right? And they may not have the co-occurring challenges that your child has, right? And so treatment may be a little bit faster. It also may be slower. The key that I look for when evaluating whether therapy is working is not about how many sessions you are and how close you are to the end. But what I'm looking for is, is my child making progress, right? The pace of the progress is not necessarily as important as the fact that you're making progress. Just like there are different milestones for when kids walk and talk, right? And how quickly they pick up their vocabulary and how quickly they start running, right? But what matters more is, are you making progress? And so if we're seeing that children are going through the anxiety treatment and they're making progress, then that's how we know we're being successful. So what does that progress look like? So at the beginning of anxiety treatment, it's really going to be about education, understanding anxiety. So we'll talk about things like false alarms versus real alarms. We can talk about the cycle of anxiety, right? The idea that when we're thinking these uncomfortable thoughts and we are feeling uncomfortable feelings that we're likely to avoid, which maintains our problem, right? So when kids can explain that back, that means that they are learning. That's an example of progress. Then we want to educate kids more about what are thoughts, right? What are examples of thoughts? What are emotions and what are examples of emotions? It's not about defining emotions. It's actually very hard to define emotions, but to be able to label their emotions in particular situations. When kids are anxious, we don't only want to teach them what anxiety is. Kids in general benefit from emotion education about a range of different emotions. So we're focusing on anxiety as well as all the other emotions, right? This way they can distinguish between anxiety versus the other emotions. So we're learning about their emotions. They're learning about their thoughts. And the last piece would be learning about those physiological feelings they're experiencing, right? Can they label that their stomach hurts, that their heart is beating quickly, right? Those physiological sensations. Once they're able to do that, then we start to talk about tools to really be able to help. And so there's a primary treatment for anxiety called cognitive restructuring. What I would really translate for you is putting your thoughts on trial, right? Evaluating our thoughts. How likely is this to occur, right? Are there certain thinking traps that we are falling into, right? Like we're having like what I call it's the end of the world thoughts or black and white thinking. It's all or nothing thinking when really the situation might not be all bad or all good, right? So, and then being able to come up with alternative, more accurate ways of looking at situations that may result in a reduction of anxiety. The other piece, and really the primary piece of anxiety, right, that we're working our way up to is going to be what we call exposure or facing your fears. And to do that, we're helping kids come up with a list of a variety of situations that they're feeling uncomfortable with at a range of different levels. And then we are helping them be able to be brave and to face those fears. And the more you do it, the easier it gets. There's good news and bad news when it comes to the treatment of anxiety. The good news is that there's really great research to show that therapy works. The bad news is the way to get better is to face what you fear.
Wow. Wow. I love how you really explained anxiety and the depth of it. And I like that you have different options for treatment as well as like a clear path. You know, sometimes I hear like, you know, practitioners, therapists say like, oh, treatment lasts forever. I like that with your cognitive behavioral therapy that there is some sort of timeline there. Like you said, everyone's individual. And I get asked as an occupational therapist all the time, how long is my treatment going to be? And I can't answer it because, you know, we build neural networks at different levels. Every child, every individual is different. But I do love how you, you know, definitely give it a little bit of a time frame. So that's a really nice piece of the cognitive behavioral therapy that you have a certain like structure there. Okay, with obsessive compulsive disorder, also known as OCD, could you sort of explain what it is, how one would say, I know people are like, oh, I'm OCD, and they're really not OCD. So if you could give us the clinical definition of what OCD is, and then we could also discuss a little bit about what's misunderstood about the diagnosis.
Sure. So when we think about OCD, we would think about the obsessions as well as the compulsions. And obsessions you can think of as being like the thoughts, the images, the impulses that come into an individual's head. And I'll give an example in a moment. Obsessions are going to increase anxiety, right? And because of the fact that an individual is experiencing that increase in anxiety, they're going to engage in something to neutralize or lessen that anxiety, which by definition we call a compulsion. A compulsion is the act that an individual engages in order to neutralize the difficult thought that they are experiencing, right? So your classic example of OCD would be like hand washing, right? Think about an individual who is experiencing, you know, a fear, right? Or a thought that they are contaminated, right? And if they are contaminated, right? That is very uncomfortable for them. The more they think they're contaminated, the more distressed they get. And so what is the way that an individual who is contaminated is able to reduce their anxiety about it? They wash their hands. But of course, what happens, similar to the cycle of anxiety and similar to the cycle of a tic, which is how these conditions are really all related in a way, is that when you wash your hands, you're not actually fixing anything. But if anything, you might be maintaining the discomfort. You're making it more likely that the next time your fear happens, you're going to wash your hands again. And that's how you end up in a cycle. And so OCD, much like anxiety, it has a cycle where you experience your obsession, you engage in your compulsion, you feel better for the moment, but then it comes back again. And your cycle starts. And so we see OCD happening in a variety of different ways. So commonly we are seeing contamination-related fears. We are also seeing fear, you know, and fear is related to, concern about dirt, concern about germs, like all of those contamination related moments. But we're also seeing obsessions where individuals may have certain like loop tapes that occur. An individual that I'm currently working with has an obsession related to the past. And so what actually is happening is he is replaying scenarios in his head because he's saying to himself, I should have said something to that person. I really need to confront them. And so he actually spends, you know, hours and hours a day, you know, worried about or thinking about what could I have said differently? How can I teach that person a lesson? Should I call them? Now, he hasn't actually reached out and it's been 5 years. And that's because what we're talking about is this about the person needs to learn a lesson? Or is this about the way that your brain has kind of like latched onto it? So what's happening in OCD in a way is you can think about we all have thoughts all the time, right? So picture like a big umbrella with a whole bunch of thoughts inside of it, right? And then what happens is all of our thoughts kind of go through a filter. Right. We all have uncomfortable thoughts that we think about. Many of us have driven over the George Washington Bridge and been like, it'd really suck if it collapsed right now. Right. That doesn't mean we have a disorder. Right. But what happens is that all of our thoughts go through the filter. And on the after the going through the filter, there are two buckets at the bottom. One of them are keep thoughts and one of them says junk thoughts. And so for most people, that thought about, you know, oh, I should bring something for lunch today, you know, it just goes into the keep thought and it's relative keep box and it's relatively innocent, right? And for most of us, that thought about, you know, oh, the George Washington Bridge might collapse, right? That just goes into the junk thought, right? Right? We had the thought and it's gone. But for people with OCD, what happens is the filter is kind of like malfunctioning. And so the junk thoughts actually end up in the keep thought bin. And so the idea of my hands are dirty, or the idea of I need to tell that person again, or that idea of I need to turn around my car because I might have ran somebody over when really it's just a speed bump and they've gone around the block 7 times already. So it's pretty clear there's not a person, right? What's happening is that it's just that the filter is kind of malfunctioning.
And what kind of treatment is out there for such an individual?
So it really mimics anxiety-related treatment. There are some differences, but overall, you know, it's about education and understanding what's going on, being able to identify the thoughts that you're experiencing, right? And then being able to minimize that avoidance, right? In other words, if your thought is, I need to wash my hands, then we need to be able to say, you know, like with a mindfulness element to it almost of, I'm having this thought, it's really uncomfortable, and I'm not going to wash my hands, right? But the idea is you are supposed to be distressed. And so here's what's not helpful. What's not helpful is reminding yourself, no, really, it's not a big deal. In fact, that can actually inhibit the learning process. You actually need to activate those fear sensors and engage in the uncomfortable situation in order for your brain to learn that there is, in fact, no danger and to kind of reprogram everything. So that's the behavior therapy, and then medication could work as well.
Okay. There are medications to help with such a thing.
Yes, there are medications. Medications for anxiety are generally parallel to the medications for OCD. OCD medications is usually kind of like the anxiety medicine at a higher dose. But there are some exceptions, and always with medicine, just like with therapy, this is where, you know, talking to the medical professional is most helpful.
Wow. Very insightful. Thank you. Okay. Last little question before we end off. How sure. often do you see comorbidities, like where you see a couple of different diagnoses in an individual? How does that make change treatment, or are you just dealing with each one individually?
Great question. So when it comes to comorbidity, so first of all, to answer your question about how often do I see it, always. But that's the nature of the work that I do. So Tourette syndrome tends to kind of cluster with OCD, anxiety, and ADHD. And so many individuals have some or all of those. In general, though, on our team of doctors, we tend to see a lot of comorbidity. I don't know if that really is more or less than other clinicians do, just given the specialty nature of our work, but we see a lot of it. And so what we need to do in those situations is we really need to understand which of these challenges, if addressed, would have the most positive impact on the child and would have the most positive impact on their surroundings. And that's how we kind of decide what to treat. There are some other ways that we can decide what to treat based on certain conditions may overlap enough that if we kind of start it here, we may see some secondary results there. But in general, we're really looking at it as which of these problems, if addressed, would have the greatest positive impact on the child and the family.
Wow, fascinating. Your work is absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing with us all the different components of what you do and an individual's brain. I would love if you could end off for us with a positive message to the parents that, you know, a parent that's dealing with either one of these diagnoses or multiple diagnoses. If you had one message to share with parents, what would it be?
That's a hard question.
Okay, you could give two if you want.
If there was one message I would want to give to parents, and I think it can sound a little bit cliche, but I also think it's really true, it's that parenting is hard. Parenting is really challenging. One of the things that I have talked about from one of my first jobs through the present is the importance for parents, and I also say this to my staff, the importance for them to be able to capture those golden nugget moments. Right? There are so many challenges that we go through as parents, whether our kids are children with special needs, whether they're children neurodivergent, whatever term you want to use, or kids that don't have any of those labels, if you will. There are going to be challenges. And I think what's so important is to be able to make sure that we're paying attention to those moments. I remember that, when I was on the executive board of our shul, of our synagogue, I never wanted to make announcements. And I generally never did. But one time that I did was when the president was out, it was my task, and it was the bar mitzvah of a boy with autism. And I just remember thinking, like, that's one of those golden nugget moments, right? That those parents need to really capture and, like, soak in, you know, that that happened. And when you have those moments, that's really what carries you through. If I have another minute, I can share one more analogy, which would be the idea of many times I think when we're parenting, particularly the listeners to an audience, you know, the listeners in a podcast like this, we're often probably in a situation where we are raising roses in a tulip garden. And let me explain what that is. When you want to grow tulips, my understanding, I have a black thumb at best, but my understanding is you really just drop some buds in the ground. You throw some water in and your tulips will grow. They're going to grow if you put a little too much water. They're going to grow if you don't put quite enough water. Roses are a little bit different. Roses are a little bit more finicky. They're a little bit more thorny. And like you have to put in just the right amount of water when you put those seeds in the ground. And I think the idea for parenting and the message is so clear because we all can acknowledge that, you know, roses could be more difficult, right? But they're still roses, right? And many ways, those are the flower, right? Anybody who's ever had an anniversary knows there's only one flower you come home with, right? And there's a reason for that because they're roses, right? And so many times, though, we feel as parents that we are raising roses in a tulip garden, and that's okay. So many times we look around as parents and we're like, why didn't that kid have a meltdown at the baseball game? Why didn't that kid develop, you know, have so much trouble developing friendships the way my child is? Why, you know, and a lot of times we think to ourselves, what's wrong with me as a parent? The honest truth is probably nothing. Many of the kids out there, whoever told them how to listen, they would have just listened. You didn't need to get your language so precisely correct, right? But roses are just a little bit different. And I think the message for parents is that it's a blessing in a way that those children had you to be able to bring them to where they are. So many times with roses, if it wasn't for parents, like the kinds of parents that I see in my office, the kinds of parents that are invested in reading a self-help book, the kinds of parents who are invested in listening to a podcast to be able to be the best mom, dad, or caretaker that they can be. If it wasn't for that, who knows where their children would be? And so capture those golden nugget moments and be kind to yourself, because you're probably doing awesome.
I love that message. That was an amazing message. I'm actually like feeling like the goosebumps now, because it's so true and it resonates so much. When, you know, I work with parents all the time, exactly, and they're the ones that are doing the greatest job, and they're the ones that are so worried that they're not. And I'm gonna forever hold on to that rose, the tulip garden and the roses, because I think it's just so beautiful. Thank you, Dr. Flansbaum, for coming on today and sharing all this knowledge with us. You were amazing. You explained the topic so well. And I think our listeners will definitely appreciate everything you had to share with us today.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.